The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. Can you hear all right, everyone? Came back yesterday from teaching a week-long retreat, and the retreat is still with me, kind of both energetically and also in terms of the theme of what we talked about at the retreat. There was a theme. The theme was what's known in more technical Buddhist language as the five jhanic factors, the five factors of absorption. And in Buddhist meditation, when it becomes really strong, we get as absorbed in meditation in similar way that we might get absorbed in a really good book or absorbed maybe in a movie or something. There's a variety of things in life we get absorbed in, and where the absorption in them, it feels nice. It has a really good feeling to be. It's very satisfying. So the same thing can happen in meditation. We're going to be involved in meditation so deeply, so fully, that it feels really right, very satisfying to be so fully absorbed or engaged. And so the tradition emphasized five different psychological factors that come into play that support that ability to be fully absorbed. So I want to talk about those a little bit, and since they're fresh on my mind. But I want to talk about them a little bit, not as factors for deep meditative practice, but rather as something that's relevant for our everyday lives. That how we engage in what we do is, from the point of view of our own inner well-being, how we are is as important as what we do. And for some activities we do, the how we are is actually more important than the what. And for meditation practice in particular, how we meditate is at least as important than what we do in meditation, how we meditate, what kind of meditation we do. The how we are is very important. What comes into play? What are the psychological inner factors that come into play as we practice? So, and I learned a lot about this absorption in activity from my Zen training. So I spent many years practicing in Zen monasteries, and I didn't know, we didn't use the language of what's called the five jhanic factors there. What we were told in Zen training was when you did something, you were supposed to do it wholeheartedly. And I was, I don't know if reprimanded is too strong of a word, probably it is, but I was advised often that about how I was, how to be more wholehearted in the things that I did. So sweeping, there's a lot of sweeping in Buddhist monasteries. And so, you could kind of like just, kind of path, raking or sweeping the pathways, and you could either just kind of lightly dabble, lightly kind of touch, or half-heartedly do it, and then that would be pointed out to you. You weren't really there, and sometimes someone would actually take the tool from you and show you what it was like to really put yourself in and really engage with the sweeping, and you don't just kind of like, with one little hand, kind of half-heartedly kind of, scrape a little bit or push a little bit, and look around, and then you get around to do it again. But you take both arms, you hold the broom or the rake, and you're really there. It's like the rake and the broom and the floor is the most important thing in the world at that moment. And you want to give yourself completely over to that activity. And so this idea of giving yourself over wholeheartedly, completely, to what you did was a regular part of Zen training. It was how they train you in Zen. In fact, in traditional Zen monasteries, it's possible maybe to say that the everyday activities you do in the monastery are more important for the training in Zen than the meditation that is done. And in Japan, when I was in the monasteries in Japan, some of the monasteries there, they didn't do that much meditation. I mean, not that much. Not that much meant twice a day. But then you did a lot of sweeping and a lot of activities. And some of it, you know, seemed pretty silly. One of the silly activities was, so there were about, 35 monks living in the monastery. And I don't know, a good percentage of us, especially the ones who were more junior, were assigned to mow the lawn. So I don't know how many, there were 25 of us to mow the lawn. And you know, it wasn't like it was a big monastery, but the lawn wasn't that big. But what we had for mowing the lawn was scissors. And so that seems, you know, like, isn't this a waste of time? One person can mow the lawn, you know, much faster than 25 people with scissors. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter if it was efficient or not efficient. What mattered in the Zen training that you did it wholeheartedly. No one was damaged, you know, by, you know, mowing the lawn with scissors. And none of us, I don't think any of us were damaged. We were young and, you know, good knees. Someone might think, well, that's silly. Get a lawnmower, have one person mow the lawn, and everyone else can meditate. I mean, your meditation is really important. That's where the spiritual life really is. You know, really you can get work on your meditation and go deeper and deeper and deeper, you know, whatever. No, the idea was that, not that mowing the lawn with the scissors is good spiritual practice. What was good spiritual practice, as good or maybe better than meditation, was to really, when you do it, really be there and fully engaged without resentment, without, you know, exasperation, without complaint. You were told to do that, you just really do it full-heartedly. And an example of this when I was in the Zen monastery, I went one evening to talk to one of the cooks. He was doing some prep work in the kitchen, chopping something, vegetables, I think. And I had to ask him something, or asked him something. And so I asked him something, and then he put down his knife, stood up straight, and answered me. He finished answering me, picked up his knife, and started his work again. So I asked him a second question. He put down his knife, stood up, and answered me. Picked up his knife, started... So I asked him a third question. You know, I'm kind of slow sometimes to understand what was going on. And the third time he put down his knife and he stood up and he said, Gil, I'm only going to do one thing at a time. I'm going to either be here and do my vegetable chopping or I'm going to talk to you. But if I go back and forth, I can't get my work done. So I bowed and thank you. And that was the last of my questions. The idea that, you know, so he was practicing the Zen training, you just give yourself fully to this one thing. So what is it like to give yourself wholeheartedly to any activity? One of the interesting answers to that question is to ask the reverse for you. What does it look like when you're not wholehearted? What does it look like when you're half-hearted? What does it look like when you don't give yourself completely to the activity you're doing, if you're washing dishes or doing laundry, or there's all kinds of things you can be doing. And nowadays, I think there's all kinds of situations where people were wholehearted in doing something that now they're not really there for, because they can pull out their phones and check for emails. You know, there used to be, sometimes in the Zen monastery we have to wait in line. And so the idea was then you were wholeheartedly waiting in line. You're just really there. You were just there, you know, boom, you know, waiting in line, you know. In fact, you're so fully there that the idea of waiting was like extra, just you were there. Can you imagine all the line of these Zen monks, you know, there in line, and then they pull out their cell phones. You know, that doesn't work very well for the training. You know, if the training is to learn this capacity to be here fully for something. And this translates in all kinds of ways, this wholeheartedness. It also translates to being with someone else, to be really present for someone, to really listen carefully, to be wholeheartedly there, fully present. Someone who's in distress, to have the capacity to really be there. Boom, you're there. So what keeps you from that? Do you understand the forces? Do you understand your distractibility? Do you understand the momentum of your life that keeps you jumping around from one thing to the other? That you can't really be there fully for one thing. I used to, well, one example that I used for this was, maybe you had the experience of shaking someone's hand. They say, "Oh, hi," they say to you. And so you shake hands, but as soon as their hand touches yours, they're off to the next person, and you have this limp hand. You know, it doesn't, you know, it's like, oh, you know, what was that about? You know, but then there's a person, then there's people, of course, the people that crush your hand. That doesn't work either. But then there's the people who, like, maybe shake your hand or are really there, and you feel like they're really stopped and they're really there, just you for that moment. I've heard stories about the Dalai Lama, that the people who've been in his presence. And they say that, you know, that he will stop for complete strangers and look at them as if for that moment they're the most important person in the world. And it transformed, it changed people to be seen by the Dalai Lama this way. Just, you know, right there, fully there. But when the Dalai Lama passed me by, he ignored me. What happened was that I was, he was going to do a little audience for all the staff and teachers at Spirit and their families at Spirit Rock. So, I don't know, 100 people or so gathered together to do some special event with him. And so I went with my whole family. And my son was, he was speaking then, so he must have maybe 2 or something. He was pretty young. And I said, we were saying, going to see the Dalai Lama. And he said, "Oh, the big alpaca?" And so we went up there and in this room. But he was too young to be able to sit there. So, you know, I'm around this kind of scene a lot, so I took him outside so my wife could be there. And so we were actually outside in the lobby outside where the Dalai Lama was. And at the end of his presentation, you could hear they did some chanting. And while I was holding my son in my arms. And at the end of the chanting, my son joined in. And at the end, and so everyone stopped chanting because it was over. And then you could hear through the building my son, E-I-E-I-O. And then my son came down. And so the Dalai Lama came out first. He was the first to exit, you know, respected men like that. So we were there in the lobby, you know. And so he came over. He saw my son, not me. And so he came over and he kind of, you know, patted my son very nicely. And then he walked on. So that's how I was ignored by the Dalai Lama. So this wholehearted. So these factors, the Buddhist tradition then champions 4-5 factors that are important. And so, rather than thinking of them as having to do with deep absorption, I'll never get that, that's too hard. These are things that are common in our lives. And I trust that you probably sometime in your life, in some activities you do, you probably recognize that these are in play. And to learn to recognize the different functioning of our minds, or our psyche, is very helpful, because this is one of the ways to find our way forward. So one of the ways to find out how to be in this world is to become wiser and wiser in how we work inside, the mechanism, the operating system that we have. It's a little bit like the story, like the little idea that you can give someone lunch, or you can teach them how to farm. Lunch will be good for that afternoon. Teaching how to farm will, provide them food for the rest of their life, perhaps. So, you know, you could cheer someone up by, you know, hanging out with them, or you can teach them about, you know, how their mind works. And as the more and more they understand how the inner life works, the more they can kind of take care of themselves. So Buddhism has a lot of different teachings about the inner ecology, how the inner ecology works. So these five factors are part of them. So the first has to do with directing the attention or placing the attention. So our attention is one of the most precious resources we have. And where our attention goes has a big impact on what shapes us. So our conditioning, for example, and the influences on us. And when we start having some choice about what we do with our attention, then we become less influenced by all the things around us that go on. But if we don't have the ability to choose where our attention goes, then our attention gets pulled left and right by all the circumstances and activities of life, and we feel like we're kind of more victims to circumstances than we are masters of circumstances. So in Buddhism, learning how attention works and to begin to have some ability to engage it and use it is very important. So the first factor is choosing where your attention goes and directing it there. And so I think we do that all the time, right? You get in your car to drive and, you know, whether you're consciously or unconsciously doing it, you're choosing to pay attention to the road as you drive, right? You put down your cell phone and you look while you drive. If your mind wanders off, you know, you see something interesting side of the road, you bring it back pretty quickly, back to the road, and you keep looking on the lookout for the traffic in front of you. So you direct and you bring your attention, you place it somewhere. So this can be a choice, and a choice is supported by understanding where it's useful to put your attention. And so if you're doing some activity, you want to put your attention into the activity. In the Zen monastery, what we were trained to do, if you're using your hands, like chopping vegetable or something, you are there fully as you can with the vegetable, but also you put your attention in the part of your body that was doing the work. You really were there with your hands. And one of the things I learned, one of the great teachers for me in the Zen monastery was the carrots. Because I was assigned to the kitchen to be a prep cook, and I had no interest in being a prep cook and never chopped much vegetables in my life. And there was just me and the carrots left there. But there were 50 people in the monastery, and so you had to chop a lot of carrots and onions. So I'd be standing there at the cutting board and all these carrots and onions to do. And literally, I had my body turned away from the cutting board, pointing to the door. You know, the way out. And I would, I would kind of not use my left side of my body and my left hand, and what I was doing is kind of like just, you know, tapping at it, or kind of like, you know, uncommitted. You know, I had commitment problems. And so I was kind of like, and so I noticed this because one of the trainings in the Zen monastery was to really pay attention a lot to what you do in your posture, what you do with your body. So I really started noticing that I wasn't really there physically in my activity. And I learned to turn myself around and really face the carrot. And just me and the carrot, just really be there. And then I'd find myself going away, you know, and like, okay, come back. So I would place my attention on the activity I was doing. And I had to keep doing it because I didn't quite get the lesson very fast. It took me a while. And I had important things to do, right, out there. Somewhere that it wasn't here. But so to come back, so the placing attention, choosing the attention here this, what I'm doing now. And so the mind does wander off, and then to come back, to place it back where it wants to be, where you'd like it to be. And this coming back and placing it where you want and is a muscle that we can develop and have more choice about using, and to be able to recognize more quickly when attention is wandering off, what we want to pay attention to. What really helps in developing this muscle is to do something which is not inherently interesting. Because if it's like a really good movie, your mind's not going to wander. You know, you're there. But if you do something which is not particularly interesting, then you get to really start working the muscle inside of what it's, and start noticing what you're doing and what your choices are. And so you start exercising the free choice as opposed to the, you know, the fascination choice because you're so pulled into the story of the movie. So, you know, for me, carrots. Now, for some of you, I'm sure it's sitting down to meditate and watching your breath. Some people tell me, what's so interesting about the breathing? And maybe that's the point. Maybe it's not supposed to be too interesting. Maybe the less interesting, the better for you. Because then you're really training and developing. So that initial placing of attention, or directing it here. And then, the second factor of absorption, or I call it the factor of wholeheartedness, is to stay there. To hang out there, to hang in there with the experience, to sustain the attention over time. Some people can be very good at directing attention for a moment, but they can't, there's no continuity, there's no commitment there, and then the mind jumps around and goes over. And so there's a different muscle in the mind that's the muscle, hang in there, stay there, rest in that experience. A lot of that has to do with, not with brute force, but with letting go. Because you let go into the experience and stay there. You rest in the experience. Just you and the carrots. And you give in to the carrots. Okay, it's you and me, buddies. And you're like, we're in it together. We're going to stay here until it's over. And so this really, this sustaining of the attention and not allowing the mind to wander. And as you get better at this, you start noticing that the mind wants to wander or just begins. But you don't have to, but then you kind of like relax back in and you stay there. The tradition likens these two factors, the initial application of attention and the sustained application of attention, to a bird taking flight. So there's work to keep applying yourself and be there, come back, just like flapping the wings. And then when you can really stay there, then their wings have caught the updraft and you can soar, you can glide. I liken it to catching a wave surfing, body surfing, or, you know, boogie board surfing. You know, you got to paddle, you have to connect to the wave and paddle so you can be there. But then the sustain, when you really kind of get into the sustain part, it's like, you've caught the wave. And it feels that way sometimes. You caught the wave for a moment, you're there. Or I liken it also to petting the cat. You know, you don't just hold your hand on the cat. And you don't just do it once and then your hand wanders off to do something else. There's a lot of great things you can do with your hand, right? And so why should you do the cat? You place your hand on the cat, you stroke it, and then you do it again. And so the initial kind of directing of attention is like touching the cat, and sustained is like petting it. The reason I like that the analogy of the cat petting is that as we get into this wholeheartedly giving ourselves over to the one experience in a relaxed way, it becomes enjoyable. And the cat begins to purr. So you begin to purr. There's something about giving ourselves wholeheartedly in a relaxed, committed, full way, just absorbed in an activity, that it must be really good for our psychophysiology. Maybe something happens in the nerves or in the hormones or something, that something happens that, you know, there's a feeling of well-being that wells up. Partly it's because the more wholeheartedly your attention is directed in something that's wholesome and good to do, the less it's involved in unwholesome activities, less it's involved in the kind of thinking that is stressful. And the fading away of stressful thinking helps the body to relax deeper. The more deeply the mind and body relax, a greater sense of well-being can just be there, because much of people's lack of well-being is not inherent, but comes from kind of how we think often, or our reactivity and our built-up stress and all kinds of things. And as that falls away, a natural well-being arises. A lot more energy arises. And the analogy I like for that, or the example I get, is if you take and hold your fist really tight, make a really good fist, really get into it and hold it for a while. You don't have to do it. I don't want any damage here. It's enough for that I do it. So really hold tight for a long time. And then at some point, it's so much that it hurts and I get tired. And then at some point, I let go of my tight fist, open up my hand. I release the pressure. And for a few moments, for a little while, this very strong sense of well-being occurs in my hands. I feel relief. I feel all this blood, maybe blood flowing, this energy, this tingling. It just feels really delightful in there to feel that release. So the same thing happens psychologically, is that when we have a lot of tension, psychological tension, and then it gets released, there's the inner energy begins to be freed up and flow through us. And there's a sense of well-being that arises. So that the well-being that arises is divided into two kinds. And these are the third and fourth of these jhanic factors. The third is joy, and the fourth is, it's sometimes called happiness, sometimes called contentment, or a deep, deep happy satisfaction. And the joy is more like the thrill of having your fist released finally. Wow, oh, that seems so good. The happiness is more like, after a while, the all the energy and the surging blood and all that, whatever, the initial excitement and thrill of the release has faded away, but you're left with a feeling, ah, that's nice. It's really nice. So as we give ourselves wholeheartedly something, sometimes there's a variety of sense feeling of joy or well-being. And I suspect that some people, like when they read a really good book or some good hobbies you do, and you feel kind of a sense of well-being, it's the well-being that people enjoy a lot, more so than maybe the particular activity. And they don't maybe they can't really separate the two, so they say, well, it's the building those model airplanes that I really like doing. But for some reason, the model airplanes, when they're really there, brings a sense of fullness and wholeness and well-being that's there. Part of this sense of well-being comes from a sense of wholeness. So this wholeheartedness means you're whole. And whole means that we're not divided against ourselves. We're not fighting parts of ourselves or criticizing parts of ourselves or holding parts of ourselves at bay. There's no energy of that at all going on. It's like more like we're just complete and whole. It's a great thing. And so wholehearted engagement in what we're doing leads to a sense of well-being. Sometimes it can be quite strong, the joy, the thrill, and sometimes it fades away, and it just feels like a very deep, peaceful happiness, or sense of deep contentment and happiness and well-being. So the fifth factor that comes into play with this is called, usually in English, it's translated as one-pointedness. And I kind of prefer not to use that, because at least in my little mind, when I hear one-pointedness, I think of the laser focus from the control tower. I'm just going to zero in and just really kind of be one-pointed on what. That kind of attention, it tends to be more stressful than helpful. The wholehearted attention that that I think that Buddhist practice is pointing towards is not a laser focus, but rather a full involvement with all our faculties. Like we bring all of ourselves fully there for the experience, not just, you know, some little capacity in the mind. And sometimes I like the word wholeheartedness as a translate, you know, not a translation, but as a way of talking about this factor. The other thing that I like is to call it a single-mindedness, to be single-minded in what we do. It means that you're not distracted, you're not focused on anything else. You're single-mindedly, your whole mind is involved with this one activity for the time that you're doing it. Now, we know that being single-minded, it can be imbalanced, if that's, you know, so we're not talking about, excessive single-mindedness all the time, but serial single-mindedness. polygamous single-mindedness. You know, you're single-mindedly there for the activity that you've chosen that moment, for that time, for that minute or whatever. But then, you know, you go do something else. Then you're single-minded for that. Your single-mindedness, you're really there for that one activity. So all of you is there, wholehearted, complete. So all this is pointing also not only to the idea of well-being and happiness can be there, but it also points to a feeling of being, having integrity or having wholeness, feeling complete, not feeling divided, not feeling held back, not feeling inhibited, not feeling scared, not feeling... and the opposite also can be a problem. If you're overly engaged, it's possible to attack things. And attacking something or really, doesn't conduce to this relaxing into, letting go into it in a way where this inner well-being wells up. The image of the well-being that the tradition gives that comes from these jhanic factors is that of a lake that has a natural spring at the bottom of the lake that sends water up into the lake and suffuses the lake with water. So it's a peaceful, slow movement of something. So it's not a storm. It's not greedy. It's not pushing. It's something that's kind of like water-like that, you know, kind of just flows through us in a nice way. Kind of suffuses the whole lake. Again, the wholeness of the experience. So five factors of wholeheartedness. So I would suggest that you consider through this next week, see if you can notice when some of these might be in play for you. When out of choice, do you bring your attention to something? And really, when out of choice, do you bring your attention over there to something and then sustain it and really give yourself fully to that one thing? So not just your attention by your eyes or your thinking or something, but like your whole being. So like, you know, you're not turned towards the door and paying attention, but you're like really there with the carrots, with the dishes, with whatever you're going to do, folding the laundry. One of the things that I've thought about is, you know, I spent a lot of time in monasteries, and I've had people say to me, well, that's nice for you, but, you know, I can't go off to a monastery and practice. I have kids and jobs and responsibilities, and I'll never be able to do that. And so I guess I won't be able to practice as well as you did. The practice in a monastery and the practice outside in their life is not actually that different. You do a lot of the same activities. Monastics fold their laundry. They chop their vegetables and cook and do all kinds of things. Probably one of the factors that makes a really big difference in the monastery is that you're supported and encouraged when you do something to just do that one thing at a time. And if you want part of the experience, the benefits of monastic life, or experience some of the growth that can happen in monasteries, you go a long way by just looking at the simple things you do in your life, the ordinary things every day, and give yourself wholly over to that. So, for example, you've put your laundry in the washing machine. You come back an hour later, right? And it's time to put it in the dryer, perhaps, if that's how you do your things. So you're on the other side of the house or someplace. And so I've done this where I've been living the last 20 years in very small places. So, but I have to cross from one part of the house to the other part to get to the dryer, the laundry, right? And so my purpose is to go and put the clothes from the washer to the dryer. That's what I'm going to walk to do. That's what I'm set myself to do. So I start. That's the initial application, initial thing I'm going to do. I'm going to go. But then as I'm walking there, I notice something on the table. I'll look at that. The mail came in. I'll look at the mail. And then, oh yeah, the laundry. And then I'll walk a little bit further and, you know, maybe I can have a glass of water. I'm going by the kitchen and, you know, and oh, but you know. And so, you know, I get distracted. So when you decide to go walk to the laundry area and put the clothes from the washer to the dryer, do that wholeheartedly. Just do that. And don't get distracted. Just, okay, well, I'll walk there, just there. And then when you do it, really face the washer machine. And really be there, and just wholeheartedly, just that activity. You know, don't, okay, now you're going to have to move the laundry, and, you know, it's time to turn on the radio, and make sure the TV's with you, and, you know, because you don't want to waste any time, you know. You don't want to waste time doing laundry, right? I mean, that, what a drag. You have a perfectly good life, an exciting life, and you don't want to do something boring because you'll miss out on fun. The way to have fun is to do the laundry wholeheartedly, like it's the most important thing at that moment. Just give yourself over to it and don't believe all those little voices in your head and say, this is not important. This is boring. I have important things to do. I'm, you know, whatever you do is going to. If you start listening to those voices, you start getting distracted. If you're listening to those voices, it reinforces the idea that you can't really stay and be present for one thing. So, and if you want to train yourself to develop this human capacity to really give yourself and be present, take the ordinary things of daily life and do it wholeheartedly for those minutes you do it. And I am very confident that if you do that, and train yourself in that, then when you're with the really important things, you'll do them much better. You'll enjoy it a lot more. Because it's all too easy to finally do the really important things, be involved in the really important thing that has to be done, and I got to check my email. You know, I get distracted. So, how's that? Was I wholehearted enough in giving the talk? I hope it was, you know, enough. Okay, I guess it's time. So, thank you for listening, and I hope that you have a wholehearted week and a happy Thanksgiving or whatever you say.